Welcome to the Weekly Squeak, a weekly roundup of geeky news, my weekly geeky squeak, as it were. I am still getting over a slightly heavy cold, so apologies for the sound of my voice. I have a short link section and then quite an interesting interview with Arcane. We had many discussions about how to actually pronounce it. A very interesting project, not really a startup per se right now, organized or run by some students or recent graduates in France who I saw pitch here in Berlin. And they're looking to standardize medical file formats, which it may surprise you to know, quite the state of affairs in the medical industry. So have a listen to that interview after my quick roundup of links. Beginning with one of my first passions, role-play games, board games, Dungeons & Dragons specifically. In fact, I was playing a game last night, a campaign that's been running for nearly 3 years. And I read, I think last year, I can't remember, I was reading the book for so long because it's such a long and epic book called Playing the World. I can't remember the author, but if you look up Playing the World, I think you will find it. About the very extensive history of Dungeons & Dragons. And like many of these creative pursuits where a kind of creative person starts and then isn't necessarily the business person, the business history of Dungeons & Dragons is an interesting one. Gary Gygax is a little bit like a mini Stan Lee in this case, in that he's sort of credited for creating a game, but maybe unintentionally pushed a lot of people out the way as he was doing so. He died a couple of years ago, and there's an interesting article on a website called Kotaku, I don't know. It's an Australian website that seems to have popped up a lot in my gaming feeds recently. And this is an article about his widow, Gail Gygax. Gary and Gail Gygax. It's quite a mouthful. I wonder what they called their children. about her fight to preserve his legacy. The problem is she is not the only person who wants to preserve his legacy. His children and wife from previous marriages also want to do the same thing. And the interesting thing here, which is also not that uncommon, especially when you consider that Dungeons & Dragons especially has gone in and out of favor multiple times over the decades, is that now the game is popular and now the game is owned by a huge company. It's owned by Wizards of the Coast, which is owned by Hasbro. So very large toy company indeed, and is generating a lot of money, most of which the family members do not really see because of the way that things were arranged back in the day. So she's trying to, preserve his legacy, but also, to be fair, make some money out of his legacy, which I don't have a problem with. Out of his extensive archives in various basements, but so are his children, and so is his first wife, which is also fair, and they're not necessarily doing it in the most amicable way. It's an interesting article because she's also criticised for not handling his estate very well and kind of assigning rights to people to make films, etc., and then not really following up or removing them all of a sudden and things like this. She's also potentially a victim of hate attacks from fans who don't like what she's doing, but then the police reports on these attacks is sort of inconclusive as well. So, it's more like a Call of Cthulhu campaign than a Dungeons & Dragons campaign, but it's quite interesting, and if you're a fan of the game, even if you're not a fan of the game and just have a vague awareness of it, I think it is quite an interesting article. And that is an article called Fantasy's Widow, The Fight Over the Legacy of Dungeons & Dragons by Cecilia D'Anastasio over on Kotaku. From gambling with your D20s to see if you make that fundamental final blow to gambling. This is an article from Hard Fork, the next web kind of blockchain and cryptocurrency section. An article by Yessi Bello Perez entitled Problem Gamblers More Likely to Obsessively Trade Cryptocurrency, Research Finds. I think this is a research from the University of Satan the Bleeding Obvious. If you're into speculation, then of course you're going to be into gambling. In my mind, they're pretty much the same thing. Some of you may argue against that. I guess it depends where you speculate. There are safer speculations, but cryptocurrencies certainly are not one of them. And anything that had such an extreme rise was always doomed to have a fall off at some point. But yeah, this may or may not interest you, but I found it, unsurprising to read. And working in this space a lot, I meet a lot of these sorts of people, the people who've come from professional gambling backgrounds and got involved in blockchain mostly for the speculation. I am not so interested in the crypto space for these reasons, but there are a lot of people who are. And it's always been this interesting dichotomy in the space of especially the tokenized projects that rely on a value to work. And in fact, that's an interesting idea, and I don't have a problem with that idea per se, but it was possibly naive of these people to think that that would not be hijacked by speculators and gamblers. So I would love to hear your opinions on these connections. And you can find details of how to do that later in the show. A very tenuous connection from the last article to the next one. This is from The Verge, Casey Newton. Obviously, a lot of people reported on the story that Mark Zuckerberg said Facebook will shift in a different direction to more private and ephemeral encrypted messaging. But I just picked The Verge coverage. There's lots of different opinions here. There are some people who think, and I'm still undecided, I must admit, that Zuckerberg isn't necessarily the most evil person within Facebook. And maybe is just an idealistic engineer who is trying to make a product that people love and truly uniting people, like he often claims, or that he, or manipulated by others around him, dresses up product announcements that sound potentially positive that really aren't. Are they just chasing more and more customers? Are they just trying to dodge regulation, etc., because it's encrypted, so you can't touch it, kind of thing, which is often a defense of many companies that, depending on your opinion again, is an interesting conversation to have. But I guess there's a lot of criticism of how he delivered this news as well. He published, I think it was a 3,200-word blog post on... 3,200 words doesn't seem that long to me. I mean, that's less than 10 minutes to read, but still, I guess it was more that people felt he was burying the story in a lot of pointless blather when he could have just kind of come out to the point. As part of this, there's a lot of rumor that they're going to merge all their messaging platforms. This is Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp, which is reasonably obvious, and Instagram. I must admit, the trend of people messaging you on Instagram has passed me by. I need to be more active on Instagram. I'm not always necessarily very forward-thinking on how I can post images. I kind of just think of images as images, like how do I post about the podcast as an image and things like that. Of course, it's perfectly possible. But I'm just not doing that yet. Maybe I should, seeing as I hear more and more people doing this. I also heard a very interesting side discussion on this on the Daily Tech News show with Tom Merritt and others around that people often bring up the Cambridge Analytica scandal as material for why Facebook should and shouldn't do things and et cetera, et cetera. And he brought up an interesting point in that we haven't really necessarily heard of any actual negative outcomes from the Cambridge Analytica case, and it's often brought out as an example of material to fight against Facebook, but it in itself, was it as bad as people thought in terms of impact? That's not to say that we shouldn't do something and that we shouldn't be concerned, but that maybe we should stop using that specific example was the main point. And it was not my opinion, although I kind of agree, but it was an interesting sort of side discussion to this whole thing. Again, I'd love to hear what you think. Facebook, are they evil? Are they misunderstood? Can they change? Should they change? Can they change and still have a business model is possibly the more interesting aspect to this story. And finally, an article from Paul Krill and InfoWorld, one for the developers here, Visual Studio Code. So Visual Studio Code is a developer tool. It's an editor, an IDE, an editor that combines many more features to make coding easier. I use it for most of my writing. Prior to that, I used to use Atom, which was made by GitHub, but is now also owned by Microsoft. I kind of go in and out of favor with both of them. But the interesting thing with both of these is they are actually built on web technologies. Behind the scenes, they are actually JavaScript and CSS and HTML. So many people have posed the question, and I remember this question coming up in the Atom community, of can it run in a browser? I mean, in theory, it could. There's issues around things like file access and just the number of resources that it would need and a whole bunch of other security issues. But in theory, it would be possible. And this week I found it quite interesting. I haven't tested it yet. I really look forward to doing so. There is a company called Coda who have a tool called Code Server, open source, where you can run a version of Visual Studio Code in a browser. It's not fully featured. You cannot build extensions or debug extensions, but that is a fairly minor issue, I think. I'm pretty sure vast majority of the users of Visual Studio Code do not create extensions. So I'm looking forward to giving this a go. I guess it's that ability to be able to collaborate more easily. There's Visual Studio Code and Atom both already have this live share feature, which I have used once or twice in a hackathon where the two of us can work on something at the same time. You know, sort of instantaneous Git collaboration, but being able to actually open up a fully fledged editor. I'd be interested to see what extensions you can and can't run, and whether you can at all, actually. That's something that's not mentioned in the article, but would be quite important to me, for example. But I look forward to trying this, and I don't like doing everything in the browser, but there are times when it would be very useful, and especially for people with Chromebooks, iPads, etc. I guess it's another nail in the coffin of the desktop OS, sadly. And that was my roundup of interesting links for the week. And next is my interview with Alexi Toual of Ankh, an interesting little project that I saw pitch at a French tech event here in Berlin, who are trying to standardize medical data exchange in hospitals. And I learned quite a lot in this interview. I hope you do too.
All right. So I just graduated from École Polytechnique and École Normale. I did a little bit of research in cognitive science last year. And what I did mainly, I think, in my life was code and math, and a little bit of applied math to in cognitive science. And so I worked a little bit at Palantir as well at some point. And I did a lot of data integration for mainly for private companies, and because my dad works in used to work in hospitals, I had somewhat a better view, a better intuition of what needed to be done there. Mm-hmm. And so a couple of months ago, almost a year ago, we started visiting. Because I did this with a friend who's no longer with us in the project. We started to visit hospitals in order to understand how the stack of data was organized and how they could or not interact with one another. The technical diagnosis is actually quite clear. It's just that there is some sort of there is an economical incentive to not share data in an easy way. Like, I mean, when you are a software developer in healthcare, you mainly make money not out of deploying your software or not out of maintenance, but out of making money out of extracting data. So it's not the data that you sell mainly, but it's the capability of extracting it from one place, especially your database. So that's what we figured out, and we thought that the market could somewhat be easily disrupted. So it's highly political, but from a technical perspective, it's quite easy to take these databases, standardize them, and say, okay, now we are going to have two different markets, so one about data and one about softwares, and we're going to do two different things. If you code a view, then you want to plug this view onto a stack of data that is independent from what the view does, and on the other hand, if you want to do data analysis or data management, then you arrive, well, basically the stack is already implemented in the hospital that you arrive in, and you just have to add more features to it. So that's basically what we want to build, and I think we were quite keen on doing this in an open source way. So the whole purpose is not to build a monopoly. It doesn't sound very markety if I say it this way, but I think we try and build the opposite of a monopoly. Yeah. The goal is to make sure that hospitals are technically incapacity of exporting data, of managing their own data. And it's not clear that they could that they can do it at the moment. And especially, they have a strong incentive not to deploy any new technology, because if they do so, they usually lose the data that they have acquired in the past years. So because there is no transition technology, something that can make sure that they can use the data that they've been collecting for years, then they have no incentive, no true incentive of changing at all. And that's what we're trying to build. And I think there is some sort of logic in building it in an open source way.
Let's go back one step. So in a typical, as far as I can tell, are you specifically focusing on hospitals or healthcare generally first is the first question?
So I think on the short term, in the short term, we'll be focusing on hospitals and especially public hospitals. But there is some sort of, FHIR is not hospital focused. It's broader than that. So FHIR is the name of the standard that we use. It's just that, especially in France, public hospitals are sitting on some sort of a monopoly. The number of actors that are present in hospitals in France is less numerous in the public sector than it is in the private sector. So that's why we try and focus on this first.
Okay. I'd like to come back to the standard in a second. But so in a typical hospital then, I'm fortunate to say that I have not had to visit hospitals that much in my lifetime, especially recently. So my knowledge of systems is somewhat limited, fortunately. What would be some typical systems that you would find in a modern hospital and the sorts of information that it's tracking that's important to track, I guess? There's probably a lot of ancillary systems as well, but the important ones.
So mainly the stack is built so that there is one software for every task that you want to perform. So especially in France, if you go to a public hospital, the first thing you do is go to your desk and make sure that your identity is clear within the stack of the hospital. So there is one first software which is in charge of having information about who you are, when you were born, etc. That sort of information. So that's one specific task, and there is one specific software for that, which is going to store this information in a specific standard or specific language into a specific database. And then if you go to a specific service, let's say your arm is broken and you have to be to receive some medical assistance for that, you go to a specific service, and then there is one new specific software for that service. And then data collected in that service is going to be stored somewhere else in a different language, etc. So this implies that at some point you have to copy data from from any database to any other database and make sure that this data can be translated. So this results in databases not being synchronized. So they have the same pieces of data, but not at the same time. There is some sort of redundancy in these databases. And basically, the stack of applications only goes growing. You never stop using an application. You just add one for a specific task. Just to give you a hint, even a small hospital in France can have over 100 applications, all of which have their own database and their own specific language in which they store data.
And I'm guessing probably all mostly made by different companies, maybe.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it already to me though, you've mentioned this sort of being able to copy data between databases, which would imply to me that a proprietary software company is even giving the user access to be able to do that, which that actually seems unrealistic to me, knowing the proprietary software world. Is that, but they do, or?
No, what they do is they provide what they call semi-connectors. Basically, they provide hospitals with features that allow hospitals to somewhat extract data, but not directly. So let's say I'm a software company. I own a software and the database, the knowledge behind the database that is being deployed. and the hospital wants that database to communicate with another database, then as a software provider, I will give them a semi-connector, which is going to extract pieces of information at a given frequency, let's say every 2 minutes. And no one but me can do this. Like the database is so hard to understand that no one but me is able to provide these establishments with a semi-connector.
Okay.
Then there is in France what we call buses of information. So this semi-connector sends information to some sort of a central node, which then distributes this information to other databases. So the only part of the stack that is being shared, that is shared between softwares, is some sort of what they call a bus, which only receives information and transfers it to other semi-connectors.
Okay. So in passing, you mentioned this actual existing standard, this FHIR Fast Healthcare Interoperability Resources, so this, when I first encountered the project, was something that was also unfamiliar to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm guessing this is something that you're leveraging in the project. But so what is this? I don't even know what to call it. Is it a standard? Is it a...
Yep.
What is it?
Well, it's interesting. It's actually an exchange standard. So the goal of FHIR is actually to know how to ask a question and know what to expect as an answer. So, for example, if you want to get knowledge about a patient, you know exactly what you can ask and what you would get in return. So if you want to have knowledge about, encounters of a patient, you know how to link these two pieces of information. So FHIR is mainly made so as to build questions which would be standard regardless of the technology that is put behind. So it's mainly the description of an API.
Okay.
What we try and do on our end is a little bit stronger than that. We say that FHIR is also, we think, somewhat adapted to storing data.
Yeah.
We say that FHIR could be used to organize a database and that the syntax that they use in FHIR is good enough that it can lead to a consistent database schema. So in clear, what this says is that, for example, FHIR says that when you describe a patient, you want this patient to have a name, which is going to be actually a list of names, each of which should have a family name and a list of given names. So it's just a syntax. And that's how we store data and also exchange it between databases.
Okay. Is it an open standard or?
Yes.
Okay.
So there are lots of contributions, lots of people saying what FHIR should look like, how it should evolve, and most of this is open.
And I guess the important question, though, is how many of these softwares that you mentioned actually use it and conform to it?
None. Okay. None of them do. But all companies concerned actually mention FHIR as somewhat the future. So what's interesting is that FHIR has been going on for a few years now, I think like 3 or 4.
Yeah.
And there is some sort of a consensus around the idea that FHIR is the future, even though no one implements it. So there is no, and again, it's always the same problem. FHIR is cool, but there's no data in FHIR. Like FHIR is a great idea, but it's hard to convert previous data into something that's fireable.
I think
a great analogy, are you familiar with GraphQL, for example?
Yeah.
So GraphQL is not applicable, like it's not something you can apply to your data. You have to convert already existing databases, let's say MySQL, MongoDB, that sort of languages, into something that's GraphQLable. For example, that's what companies like, projects like Prisma or GraphQL do. They make databases like MySQL or just Mongo GraphQLable, so that you can query these databases with a query language that is GraphQL. Okay. So that's exactly what we're building. I think we are somewhat doing what Prisma is doing. We are the Prisma of the hospitals. We make sure that various databases can be queried in a way that is unified.
Okay. So the first most important question before we get into any more detail on what you're doing, how do you pronounce it?
So I don't really know. It depends on, but I think there is only one way to pronounce it. So we say Arcane in okay. French. I think Arcane in English would be
okay. All right. Enough. Okay. So that, I guess you've just described what it is you're trying to do. You're trying uh-huh. to, well, maybe not. Maybe let's get into a bit more detail. Is what you're trying to do provide a tool for software vendors to build into their projects? Is that what it is?
Well, I'd love to, but I think the market is organized in such a way
sure,
that
yeah.
Our target is more hospitals in the
okay.
first place.
Okay. So what could a hospital do with Arcane then?
So once they have installed it, they're basically free to do whatever they want. It's just that now they have easy access to their data and they can, for example, sign new contracts with new people who will only do the visualization of the data or the analysis of the data, but not the data management part, which I think is quite new for hospitals because they've never been in charge of the data that they've been collecting, even though they are responsible for it. So I think it's important to give them the technical possibility to be in charge of it fully.
But I think this is actually the one thing that I was still a little confused by in the presentation mm-hmm. I saw as well. How does Arcane access that data though? If uh-huh. yeah, because that's the important aspect you're trying to solve.
Yep.
And if these companies make it so difficult, how do you do it?
So in CLEAR, if you go to a hospital and you look closely at how it's organized, they just use databases locally. So physically, the databases are present in the hospital. They're located inside. And if a data manager at the hospital wants to access this data, they just have root access to it. So they're not allowed to read it, for example, as a person. They can treat it, they can analyze it, that sort of things. So what we do as a product, we just deploy our solution there.
Okay.
We no longer have, we can do nothing about it, like no data goes out or in. And then it's the hospital's task to link our product to their databases. So they just give it root access to their local databases. Mm.
I mean, this seems somewhat crazy to me, but doesn't surprise me that I guess I'm kind of pleased that hospitals aren't using cloud services, but uh-huh. I can also literally imagine just a server sat there in some office with no security.
A part of it is on the cloud.
Okay.
So, for example, radiology, imagery in general, is based on cloud solutions.
Okay. Yeah.
But most of the rest is physically present in hospitals. So that's why we are focusing on that.
And you can't access the cloud data at the moment.
And it's a little bit, they can't refuse access, but they can make it very slow.
Okay. Yeah, there's obviously been a lot of controversy around what cloud providers may or may not be doing to speed up and slow down access recently, but that's a separate conversation.
It's okay. Also, I think, an interesting point to see at that point is that as a software company selling softwares for hospitals, you don't want to be in charge of the data. It's whole different problem.
Yeah,
so there's a big incentive to leave the data in the hospital and just make it complicated enough that... Everyone has to call you when an action needs to be triggered, but you don't want to have this data.
And so there's a couple of features you mentioned, which we'll now mm-hmm. dig into a little bit. So I guess the first one is this, now you've added on a more open access layer to that data.
Yep.
And this is the data from various sources, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Developers, and this obviously, I mean, as it's an open thing, this, you know, there could be some medical staff who are developers or students or whoever, really, it's up mm-hmm. to you, can build new useful services that react to this data. Who knows? Maybe a new SMS notification system or something. Just a probably a dumb idea, but in theory now someone can just do that without having to contact a proprietary company.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. But they can't write to it. It's just reading.
So they could write to our database. They cannot write to. We will never probably take the risk of writing into other databases because we don't know the assumptions that they made in the first place. So anyone can read and write from our standardized database, and our hope is that in a not so far future, there will be a very very few databases at the hospitals. Maybe just and they might be synchronized. Like they might contain the same information, but just implement different technologies. So I'd see a point in having a MongoDB and PostgreSQL database deployed in a hospital, having the exact same information, but just providing different services. And so our goal is literally that now a hospital can be. Can quickly implement this sort implement or deploy these sort of solutions, and that someone can just, jump out of nowhere and say and implement this text messages solution, for example. Yeah. But they could write to our database. This is something that we want. Okay.
But I mean, I gave a very inane example. A lot of your team actually has. I mean, well, there's six of you, but you have one. Three and a bit machine learning NLP experts. So this, I think, is the area where you're really sort of actually focusing on. We haven't really spoken about it very much. This, I mean, I would guess the closest thing I can think of as a good comparison so far is something like Apple HealthKit, which is only really in the US, I think, but it allowed...
I'm flattered.
Well, no. Maybe just it allowed researchers to make use of data and do some quite amazing things with it, which wasn't possible before.
So,
this is something similar that you want to be able to do to allow hospitals to be able to do more complex analysis of data to make predictions and et cetera.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the idea we have behind, and I think everyone's having this idea, it's just a matter of who's going to do it first or second. As data analysts, data scientists, we've been cleaning a lot of data, and this is a great load of the time we spend on Earth was spent cleaning data and then applying a gradient G-boost, all that sort of things. So. And I think this led to some sort of frustration because the you can do this for private companies, you can do this in pretty much any field. And it seems that healthcare seems to remain immune to artificial intelligence. And I think, a simple diagnosis, I think, is that standardized data is really hard to get, and for good reasons. It's obvious that you don't want to share patients' data in a simple way. They need to. There is a need for a highly secured stack behind it. We want to somewhat build an incentive for data to stay in hospitals, and that's why we're trying to build a decentralized system for managing this sort of data. And create an incentive in the fact that this data would be standardized, so that the exchanges are facilitated between hospitals. But the goal in the end is that no data should leave these hospitals. But on the other hand, hospitals should be capable of welcoming usages of data.
Yeah.
So at the moment, data. Different kinds of data go out of the hospital, but the main data, that is the one that is related to patients, will remain inside. And it is some sort of anachronological problem. If we're not capable of training statistical models, then it's impossible to anonymize this data, and then it cannot go out. But if it cannot go out, we cannot train these sort of statistical models. So. It's kind of hard to settle this problem. What we want to build or just make plausible to build is a solution that would, for example, allow federated learning to be brought to these sorts of places. So we want the data not to go out, but the place as a decentralized node to be able to welcome works, jobs that take part into a federated learning strategy.
Yeah, and this sort of gets more interesting, the ability to be able to statistically predict. I mean, there's obviously probably a lot of stories and hearsay in hospital systems because the people on the ground will just notice patterns, but to actually have statistical analysis of the ways hospitals are used at particular times of the year and things like that, I guess. And I mean, I often the health system is one that's shown as possibly the biggest that could benefit from artificial intelligence. Doctors especially are, you know, are making educated guesses most of the time. And patients don't always tell them everything that maybe a doctor needs to know. And a lot of extra data points could really help those decisions be much more accurate. And
that's what I believe.
Yeah, it's something that I find very interesting. But I think my next question, which is potentially always the problem with this kind of idea when engineers and data scientists come to something like healthcare, is that, well, the stereotype, I don't know if this is true, but the stereotype in my mind would be that, you know, a hospital is full of healthcare professionals, not technical professionals. And even the concept of, you know, so the proprietary software companies come with sales teams and support teams that may not always have the customer's best interest at heart, but they are there to at least give you the impression they do. Whereas an open source project requires time and effort and knowledge and understanding to be able to install and set up, et cetera, et cetera. So how will you go about handling that side of things, like actually helping hospitals make use of Arkyn in the first place?
So I think this is also why we chose to be an open source project. Yeah. Like if we had every competence within the team at the in the first place, then I don't know, we would probably feel more legitimate to close it, even if it's not our philosophy. But yeah, it's basically because we don't have that sort of information, because we don't really know what use can be made of data, that we first focus on the standardization part of it. Like we're not doing any machine learning at the moment, and we don't plan on doing any in the short term or even like a medium term. So yeah, I think it's a problem that is worth being being mentioned and being being treated, but probably not by us. Like, I mean, not by a team of this size, of this age. We don't have any medical background. So I think it's because we know we don't know anything about it, that we just want to make this problem more easily solvable, but not by us.
Well, maybe to help maybe clarify the question a little with another question, do you have any hospitals testing this at the moment?
So we're deployed. So they're testing the standardization part, but they're not making use of any of the data. So it's quite a long process to actually deal with new hospitals, to find research teams that are convinced that standardization is one of the key points of the success. So it's something we're trying to build, but it takes a lot of time.
And I guess that was basically the team going to hospitals, talking to them, helping them through everything.
So it's a long process. Yeah. We have a couple of hospitals who are using they're using our solutions. Well, they have the solution deployed, but they have not made any tangible use of this data at the moment.
Yeah. And so I got to ask always the awkward question of every open source project. I mean, you have a small team. Yeah. You were at this Le French Tech hackathon, pitch event. Is there a business model idea behind this, or is it just something that you're doing, like many open source projects, for fun because it's needed, etc.
For fame.
Well, yeah, whatever. Yeah. Or is there a business idea also behind the scenes that will emerge eventually?
So we're structured as an NGO at the moment. We're still an association, and it was not our plan to monetize this solution. Like in my dreams, we were to give it for free to hospitals. Mm-hmm. So there was a business model as an association, as an NGO, which was basically to monetize the maintenance part, or just the installation part. So. Yeah. It still is the case. It's just that we see that we are not given as much credit as we want, or as much time as we need, if we don't monetize this solution in a way that people understand. So I don't know if this makes sense. Maybe we're not good salespeople.
There doesn't have to be a right answer.
We go faster, actually, at deploying this thing.
Yeah.
If we monetize it. So
I do wonder that, you know, there's plenty of open source projects that unintentionally become complex. Uh-huh. And unintentionally, you end up kind of monetizing the maintenance and support because it's easier for someone to pay you than it is to figure it out themselves sometimes.
Yep.
Do you worry that you may end up becoming just an open source version of the very companies you're trying to disrupt?
No, it's not. It does not worry me. So I think we'll be clear enough. Like, the fact that the code is open makes sure that if someone can do better than what we do, they can just do it. So. And I'm confident that we can actually monetize this for something like 10 times less than what happens in the current market. So it still is a disruption. And if we have to monetize it for good, then why not? Like, I think we're still capable of doing something that is a disruptive solution, and that would benefit greatly to the hospital. Because I think we're capable of having prices that are 10 times less than what is being paid or sold at the moment.
So for any developers who are interested in helping out, I'm just digging into GitHub now.
Yeah.
I can see, so github.com/ARKHN.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of repositories here. I can see GraphQL, I guess. Wrapper definition. I'm not sure what you call it exactly. But it looks like you'll mostly find useful contributions from Python developers by the looks of it.
Yep.
Mostly Python and some
TypeScript. So I think there are two products. For anyone who'd like to join, there are two products that we're developing at the moment. Something that is being deployed in hospitals, so that's FirePipe. So that's basically just a data pipeline. It takes data from SQL databases and writes them into a new Postgres database. So this is quite simple, and this pipeline needs instructions. So the way we have the way we decided to build these instructions is through a web platform where you can basically map concepts from a database into the FHIR standard. So that's not obvious in the first place. So what we do basically is you would have to indicate where the family name of patients is stored in the database of search or search software. So this is obviously a web app, so we need a back end, a front end, and the app is called Fireball. So this is mainly what we need help on and what we're trying to build at the moment.
And there is obviously, there's good precedent for this. I've forgotten the name of the product now, or the project, but there is a open EHR something. Open something like as a medical software that I've always seen regular hack events for it everywhere I've ever been in the world. I don't know if it's still going.
Yeah, there are many of them.
Yeah.
The law behind this is kind of tricky in France. It's not easy. It's not easy for an open team to make something that is a GDPR compliant, that is just in compliance with the law in general. But there are a couple of solutions that are open source and deployed and use an open source business model. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, people could start from there.
Okay.
There are several initiatives which go in that direction. For example, Smarts on Fire, or like other teams who work on that sort of things.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm guessing this is small and early days. But one of the questions I always ask everybody I speak to is, what's the plan for the next 6 months?
The plans for so what we've been doing for the past few months is try and raise donations for the project. So we try and work full time on this and sometimes save a day to do some freelance. But yep, this is not a sustainable model, and we'd like to somewhat be able to would like to pay people who contribute to this project for long enough that we feel like that they should get paid. But healthcare is such a market that it's kind of hard to find donations which are not very specific to one disease or like one very specific medical thing. So as a standardization tool, it's kind of hard to find donations. So we decided to switch into a different model and probably try and raise funds.
Mm-hmm.
So this will be one of the goals.
Okay.
We'll try and start selling deployment of this this software in a couple of hospitals in the coming weeks, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And what we want to focus on in the first place is compliance, GDPR compliance. So we'll be focusing on using this this tool so as to implement portability of the data, for example, when a patient asks for it, deletion of the data, since we have a mapping of the of the databases.
Yeah. Now that's actually it's an interesting point. The GDPR was seen as such a kind of a challenge, but it actually created a lot of new business opportunities.
Yeah. Exactly. And no one is doing it. Like, everyone is talking about it, I think, in hospitals, but no one has actually implemented anything around it. And hospitals are responsible with regard to the law of handling these data.
Mm.
So they have a strong incentive of having their system evolve in the coming weeks, I'd say.
And one final question.
Mm-hmm.
I guess while we're doing this interview in English, we'll have a hopefully a broad a reach for you. Do you have any plans to expand outside of France, or is every hospital system so specific that it'll be difficult in the short term?
Obviously, we have reasons to go abroad. Like the problem is very it's very global. Comparable from one country to another.
Yeah.
And yeah, we've been looking at the structure of different markets, and obviously different countries use different softwares, but the problem remains the same. And standardizing one database once you have the appropriate tools to do it is actually, it's not a piece of cake, but it's a matter of days or weeks. So, and then you have access to a whole new market. So, of course, as an open source project, we hope to reach for different countries, and that people will just take the lead on deploying this this project elsewhere and bringing contributions.
And that was my interview with Alexis of Ankh. I hope you enjoyed the interview. I hope you enjoyed the show. I am about to start recording episodes for my new show. So keep an eye on christianchiller.com/podcasts for previous episodes of this show, The Weekly Squeak, plus episodes of that new show, plus episodes of the Write the Docs podcast. We just had an interesting conversation on the differences between technical writing and marketing. If you enjoy what I do, you can also subscribe to my newsletters at christianchiller.com/newsletters, where you will find the newsletter for this show, as well as, again, some forthcoming newsletters. One of them is just about ready to start launching. And you could support the show at /support on the same website. You could also contact me there. I kind of prefer email and Twitter at Chris Chinch. So in the meantime, and until next week, if you have been, thank you very much for listening.